Good morning. I'm Colleen, and I am an alcoholic. Boy, Butcher's got a nice watch here. There was a time, I gotta be honest today, I want to thank the committee for giving me the opportunity to come and share the gifts that God has given me in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Share a little of my adventures before, because there would never be time to share them all. My home group is the Audubon group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have some members here today. My home group's in the house. Kevin and Jennifer. And some others are somewhere. And my sponsor is Mary Jane Abood. And I believe those things are so important, to have a sponsor and a home group. I've never been homeless in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was important for me to be able to be somewhere where I said I was going to be, and show up and be at the door like people were at the door for me. And COVID has changed a lot of things. And I hope that we get back to the fundamentals of standing at the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and being present and being in the meetings, because we took a hit during COVID. And there is nothing in the world like being a newcomer, because I was one, walking through a home group door and somebody putting a big hug on you and telling you that they're glad to see you. Because I'm going to tell you something, people were not glad to see me when I arrived before Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, they were saying, "Get the hell out of here. We don't want to see you anymore. You're not welcome here." And through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and solid sponsorship and the wonderful steps in this program, God has rewarded me handsomely with a friendship of many people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and a central relationship with a God of my understanding, a God that I never dreamed would really want anything to do with me. And you taught me and you showed me how to change that concept through spiritual actions in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I am very, very grateful to be here this morning. I have indeed found the fellowship that I craved. And I believe that every time I ever took a drink of whiskey or a beer or popped anything else in me to change the way I felt, that what I was really doing every single time was I was searching for God. I was searching for a God that I couldn't feel. I was searching for a God that I couldn't see. And through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I found God in you. And you led me to a relationship that is the most important relationship that I've ever had in my whole life. And you'll hear about how many I have had. My friend Vicky Wong is here from Cincinnati. I hadn't seen Vicky in a while, and Vicky was having a conversation about me that I walked up on the other night, and with a guy who used to be a member of my home group. And Vicky said, "Now, Colleen would have a relationship with anybody." And I said, "Yeah." I said, "I did have a relationship with many, and I married several. But the most important relationship that I've ever been introduced to in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is the relationship that sustains me every single day in this world, whether I'm with you in the rooms, or whether I'm in my workplace, or whether I'm in a fifth step, or doing a fifth step. It's the relationship that we all come to that is the center of our being. I'd like to remember what's on page 55, because I remember one day sitting on the side of a little hill in my front yard, and I was newly sober, And I was in one of those mental blank spots. And I remember my brother Charlie pulling up in a car. And he got out and he sat on the hillside with me, and he said, "Well, let's pull the book out." And I pulled the book out. And he drew my attention to page 55, where it says that deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God, that it may be obscured by calamity, by pomp and worship of other things. And I had obscured the relationship with God for many, 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 many years. I had obscured it with alcohol, with drugs, money, property, prestige, men, sex, all the things that I was using in my strive for unity. And the only unity that I've ever found that is permanent and lasting is the unity that I've received through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in my relationship with the God of my understanding. So thank you for that. Thank you. I grew up in downtown Louisville, Kentucky, in a public housing project. All right. Got some Louisvillians over there. We got some people from the hood. And I grew up on a corner called Hancock and Walnut Street, and in a public housing project. I'm the child of two alcoholics. My mother and father are both alcoholics. I'm the sister of three alcoholics, one of whom I had the pleasure of introducing me today. And I'm the granddaughter of alcoholics. I'm the niece of alcoholics. I'm the aunt of alcoholics. I'm the mother of an alcoholic. I married alcoholics. I divorced alcoholics. Hell, one of them divorced me. I've been around alcoholism about every way you could toss it up and throw it out. But you know the funny thing? We never called it alcoholism. It always looked like, let's go back to the Youngers after the wedding reception so we can all have a big fight. Let's go back to the Youngers after the baptism party. And everybody would pile in our house, and we had a big extended family, and all the adults would be sitting around the table drinking, and we're a singing family. We could have been the Von Trapp family Youngers. We missed that mark because we were too drunk. But we would be sitting around singing, and that's how we bonded as a family. And sometime over the course of the evening, my Uncle Jimmy would get mad at my dad about something that happened 30 years ago. And they would square off in the kitchen. And who knows what would happen then, because everything would go to straight hell in a handbasket. Table might get overturned, the police might get called, and it was kind of exciting growing up in my house. You never quite knew what was going to happen. And so growing up as a young kid, I got used to a lot of chaos. Grew up down there and went to Catholic grade school, and there was a little beer joint on East Walnut Street called the 626 Bar. We affectionately called it the Six. And the Six wasn't one of your finer places. And on Friday nights, those long, shiny cars would pull up and those good-looking guys would get out and they'd be dressed up in those nice threads like we are today. And me and my little friend, Anna Mary, would be standing across Walnut Street and we'd be looking across Walnut into the 626. And as a young kid at 8 or 10 years old, I would be thinking, I can't wait to get over there inside the 626 bar and see what's going on over there. Because my mom and dad were usually over there. And I remember getting inside that joint, and one side of the room was the bar from the front door to the back door. And on Friday and Saturday night, every bar stool was filled, and people were enjoying each other, and they were having conversations and looked like they were speaking a language that I couldn't speak. There was conviviality, uniquely the way it's described in chapter 11, A Vision for Us. And they were enjoying each other and sitting on those bar stools, and the bar was lined with highball glasses and beer bottles. And on the other side of the room, there was those little booths and the baby jukeboxes hanging off the wall, and the Platters or the Ink Spots or Motown or Patsy Cline or the Mills Brothers. My mom and dad were big music enthusiasts, and they might be up in the middle of the floor dancing or dodging a barroom fight, which usually involved my dad. And as a young kid, I couldn't wait to be sitting on those bar stools ordering the next round of drinks or putting the next quarters in the jukebox. And after getting inside that place and seeing what was going on, I never thought about the Girl Scouts again. I wasn't the Girl Scout type. I was going to be the one over in the honky-tonk. And what I remember most about my childhood was really the way that I felt. We didn't have anything. We were poor. You know, we didn't have two nickels to rub together. And my mom was busy throughout our childhood trying to fill all the gaps from my daddy's alcoholism, because my dad was the kind of guy, this is kind of how it looked at our house, we might be getting ready to have supper on a Wednesday night. And my mom would say, "Oh, I don't have any milk." And my dad would say, "I'll run over to Kroger and get some." And he'd run over to Kroger. And he'd keep rolling. He'd keep running and running and running. And then he might show back up again next Sunday, and he'd come home and he wouldn't have the milk either. And we learned early on as kids, you don't ask questions. You know, you don't say simple things like, "Where you been? Huh? You've been gone 4 days." And you know, as a young kid, I hated that. We never knew how he was going to come home, when he was going to come home, or who he was going to bring home. And you know, you fast forward 20 years later, and I'm exactly like him. I'm exactly like him. In fact, by then I'm married to a guy, my second husband, who started locking me in the house so I didn't go missing. I had to escape through the pet door. I don't know what you all did to get another drink, but I crawled through that golden retriever's pet door, and I was off and running. My best friend was waiting for me on the other side, encouraging me, "You can make it. You can make it." I was much thinner then. Crazy stuff. I was the only girl in my family. I had these three brothers, and so not feeling like I fit in was normal for me. I thought it was because I was the only girl in my family. Turns out, wasn't that at all, because I had alcoholism. And, you know, I had Charlie, who was like, you know, good time Charlie. He could sing and he could dance and everybody loved him. And I had Joey, who was, you know, outstanding with a basketball and got the big scholarship to St. Xavier High School in Louisville, a very prestigious school there, and brought a lot of positive esteem to our family. And then there was me. I was a true Kentucky Wildcat, man. I was ready for whatever was going to go down. And then there was Patrick, my youngest brother, who was so quiet we didn't even know he could talk to. He was about 16. And he started playing the guitar and singing. We're like, "Oh, he can talk." "Oh, look at there. And so, you know, I got to be about, I don't know, 12 years old, and I was running around those projects with my little hood friends, and we were doing all kinds of pranks and, you know, vandalism and all that stuff in the neighborhood, and I was a real challenge in my family, and I was the kid who acted out all of the negative behavior and got all of the negative attention, and I think I got to be about 12. My mother threw her hands up and said, "Okay, I get it. You're not princess material." And I wasn't. I was not princess material. As a kid, I always, even though you'd look at me, you'd think she's okay. You know, she's fun. She laughs. She's kind of smart and has a lot of friends. But on the inside, I was coming apart at the seams. I didn't feel like I measured up. I didn't feel like I was good enough or smart enough or pretty enough or sophisticated enough. And I always had this deficit. Like, you all had all your parts, but there was something missing in me. And I didn't know what it was. And so early on in my life, I started to use alcohol to quiet all those messages and all those feelings. It started out very innocently. By then, we had moved out of that public housing project up to a neighborhood called Germantown, another working-class, blue-collar neighborhood in Louisville where, you know, there's a 626 on every corner. And we got up to Germantown, and again, I didn't feel like I fit in. I was going into the eighth grade, and I was going to a new school, and I got over to St. Therese, and I'd been in St. Boniface all my life. I've been those same kids all my life. I didn't have the kind of simple self-esteem skills to integrate me into a new situation with new people. So I got in that classroom that year, and a couple weeks into the school year, and I had that long hair, and this kid sitting behind me was pulling my hair, and he was tying it up in pencils, and he was doing all that stuff that boys do to girls in the eighth grade. And I said to myself, he's not going to do it today. Because I've been going home fighting Joey Younger all my life. You know? And he was tough. And so the guy tied my hair in a pencil again, and I stood up and I turned around, and I mean, I walloped him. Good old public housing project wallop. I got him. Sister Amelia came running out of the principal's office. She said, Colleen, little girls don't fight. I'm like, I'm going to have to take Sister Amelia down to Clarksdale Friday night so that we can get good and acclimated to each other and she can understand me, because nobody seemed to ever understand me, you know. And shortly after that, I had my first drink. It started out fairly innocuous. My older brothers were going back down to the old church at St. Boniface for midnight mass, and I talked Charlie into letting me tag along, because Charlie was always my hero. You know, he was like a rock star to me. I just wanted to hang around with him all the time. I still do. And so he let me tag along. We got down there, and we went to midnight mass, and after mass, we went over to some of the old friend's house or apartment, and I was sitting on the steps that night in that apartment, and I was a 13-year-old kid that didn't feel good about herself and felt awkward and unsophisticated and unintelligent. My oldest brother came over and handed me a bottle of beer. And what happened in my mind before I ever took a drink of that beer was I wondered if I was going to get more. I hadn't had any, and I wanted more. I hadn't even had the first one, and I wanted the second one. So, you know, I think in Alcoholics Anonymous, they call that the mental obsession. And I took those drinks that night, and I don't know if it was two beers or three beers. I can guarantee you this, I got my share, because I always did. And if I didn't, that's still yours. And I drank that night, and alcohol changed the way that I felt. Alcohol changed. And, you know, the spiritual appendix in our book talks about a profound change in our reaction to life. Sitting on those steps at 13 years old and drinking those few beers that night, I had a profound change in my reaction to life. And for the next 18 years, 19 years, alcohol became my foremost priority. And it was everywhere that I went. I didn't go into places. I didn't hang with people where I wasn't going to be able to drink. It was the most important thing in my life. I was a blackout drinker early on. As a young teen, adolescent, I started having blackouts early in life. I got to be 17 years old, graduated from high school, and my childhood sweetheart had come home from Vietnam, and this was a good guy. This was the guy you want your little sister to marry. This was the guy you want your daughter to marry. And he wanted to get married. And I always kind of had this magical thinking that once this happens, then I'll be okay. So Michael and I got married, and I was 18 years old, and I wasn't okay. And we spent the next 5 or 6 years in a relationship of him trying every way in the world to get me to love him the way that I would have told you I loved him, to get me to accept his love. But you see, at 18 and 20 and 22 and 24, I didn't know that I was suffering from a spiritual malady. A spiritual malady that is an inability to experience love. I can't love you, and I can't let you love me. That's what I did all my life before Alcoholics Anonymous. I draw you in, and then I push you back and abandon you, because I didn't know how to let you love me or to love you. That was a sad 6 years, five and a half, 6 years of our lives, because this was a good guy, and I drug him through a lot of alcoholism. By now, he's working night shift at Ford, and he's coming home with all of the overtime paychecks, and I'm running around at the headrest on Frankfurt Avenue with Y. Charlie. I knew him when he was Y. Charlie. And we were having a big time. And it wouldn't be long, and I'd be greeting Michael on the front porch of our home because he'd be coming in from working those overtime shifts at 4 or 5 in the morning, and I'd be coming in from working that overtime shift at the headrest bar on Frankfurt Avenue. And I might have 6 or 8 or 10 people with me. And you know, it wouldn't be long into that marriage, and he would have that look on his face. And I know that if you have ever loved an alcoholic, or if you are an alcoholic, I know you know the look that I'm talking about. Because if the look had words, this is what it would say. I love you, but I hate your guts. And that's where we were. And I didn't know how to get out of it. I didn't know. I didn't know that I had a problem with alcohol. And he would be the first person in my life, Michael would be, to tell me I had a problem. And I remember standing in the kitchen of that little home that we had, and we'd been married probably, I guess, maybe 5.5 years by now. And we had already had lots of problems of me, trying to get me to behave, trying to get me to come home, trying to get me to do the right things, and you know, trying to get me to cook dinner. And sometimes on Wednesday night, I'd put the pot roast in the crock pot, and then I'd take a drink, you know, prior to him coming home from work, and me and the pot roast would go to hell in a handbasket. You know? There would be no pot roast at Ramers Avenue that night. And I remember standing in that little kitchen that morning, and he looked out of his sober eyes, and I was coming out of an alcoholic stupor. And he suggested to me that I needed to go get some help. Now, back then, in the late 70s, there was only like Our Lady of Peace, and you went there for mental issues. And although I could have qualified, that was highly offensive to me. And he was asking me to go get help that day. And I knew I needed something, but I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what was wrong with me. And I had this Jekyll and Hyde thing going on in my head. You know, yes, no, yes, no. And Dr. Jekyll would say, go ahead. Go get in the car and go to Our Lady of Peace and get help like he wants you to. And then Mr. Hyde would raise his ugly head and he would say, get out of here. You're never going to be able to go to the headrest again. You're never going to be able to do the things that you love to do. You know, and I would leave him that day. I left that marriage, and the last thing that he ever said to me as I walked out of that home that morning was, Colleen, you'll never find anybody that loves you the way I do. And guess what? I never did. I found them. Found plenty of them. Plenty of them. But you know what? Two dingbats don't make a bell. Now, those are words that were spoken to me, directly to me, from Jack Sullivan. How dare him, right? So I left that marriage. I was working in the mayor's office for the city of Louisville. I thought that was a real hot shot thing to do, you know. And I was leaving halfway through the day, or going out to lunch and not coming back, and you know, or coming back in a blackout. Or by then my drinking has progressed that I am really, really sick in blackouts all the time. And I ended up losing that job and went to work in county government. You know, I could get a job, but I couldn't keep a job. I couldn't keep it. Went to work in county government, and I ended up losing that job, and I ended up being a bar waitress in a little bar called the Decanter Bar downtown. Now, I was a terrible bar waitress because I was trying to figure out how to get you to wait on me. I was bad. And my boss from time to time would say, would you mind getting up and waiting on those people? And I liked to work there because I drank all the booze I wanted free, you know. And I met another guy. You know, and it seemed like to me, you know, they do say that we're driven by 100 forms of delusion. It did seem like to me that the door of the decanter bar opened up and Warren came in on a big white horse. That's what I remember. But really, he didn't. Warren drank just like me. And we set out on a relationship where we nearly killed each other over the next 5 years. And we had all of the finer things in life. He had a good career. He was a stockbroker. And we had a beautiful home in one of the most prestigious areas of Louisville called Seneca Gardens. And we had all the things. We traveled. We did everything we wanted to do. And then we went home and to all those beautiful things, and we fought like two cats. And we really deteriorated to a level of spiritual brokenness that I had never experienced before in my life. I left him and moved in with my best friend who had a little apartment over off Frankfurt Avenue. By now I'm in my late 20s, and I'm living with Barbie, and she's paying the rent because I don't have a job. And I remember getting a phone call one night on a Thursday from my dad. Now, I was my dad's girl. He was missing a lot, and everybody else was mad at him, but I was his girl. And he had come home from the hospital. My daddy was 58 years old when he died from alcoholism. And he said something to me he used to say a lot. He said, "I'd like to see your smiling face." And I said, "I'm on my way, Daddy." And I got in my car to drive over to Julia Avenue, about a 10-minute drive from where I lived. And I stopped. Uniquely the way it refers to in the doctor's opinion, where it says that we succumbed and we made the supreme sacrifice rather than to continue against the fight. And I had to have a drink. And I stopped up there at that little joint that I was going to, and I took a drink, just like it refers to, prior to the important engagement. And I didn't make it over there that night. That was on a Thursday. And sometime 3 or 4 days later, I think on Monday morning, my mother called me very early in the morning, telling me that they had been trying to find me all weekend and didn't know where I was. And you know, I couldn't tell them where I was, because when I take a drink of alcohol, I can't predict to you how long I'm going to drink, what I'm going to drink, who I'm going to drink it with, or what we're going to do once we drink it. Because I didn't know that once I take a drink of alcohol, that something happens in me that is called a phenomenon. And I have to have the second drink more than I had to have the first drink. And it grows exponentially until I am either face down, passed out, or physically unable to take any more alcohol. I hated myself for that. By now, my brother Charlie is sober for 45 days in Alcoholics Anonymous. You all were starting to come around. And it felt like the heat had just been turned up about 25 degrees. And I remember being at the funeral home that weekend and all the people from his newcomers group coming and standing beside him as the newcomer going through the loss of a parent. And I was hiding out from you all because I didn't want what you had. I didn't want any part of it. And I wasn't ready to stop drinking. That was 1982. My sobriety date is August the 2nd of 1985. So I was in and out, and I can remember during those years, Charlie took me to my first AA meeting, a little group called the Second Tuesday Group, over at Second Pres in Louisville. And I sat on the front row in my first AA meeting, and I laughed and I cried, and I got up and I went right back to the bar stool at Jim Gravett's Tavern because I was different. I was going to find my way out of this thing, and it wasn't going to include you. Wow, how we try to cheat ourselves. How we try to cut ourselves short. I don't know anybody that fights against grace and gifts the way alcoholics do. But we do. And it's that self-will thing. It's that self-knowledge thing. This time it'll be different. You know, the great obsession of every one of us is that somehow, someday, we will be able to enjoy and control our drinking. I ended up in a place over on Goss Avenue with some people that I had not been raised to be comfortable with. Because my mom and dad were drunks, but we knew the difference between right and wrong. And I had a maternal grandmother that was probably the best grandmother to this day I've ever met in my whole life. And we knew the difference. And I was now seeking lower companions because I could look at them and I could say, if I ever get that bad, if I ever act like that, if I ever do that, I'd always draw a little line, you know, a little line. And I came to in this place one morning in 1983, and I was broken, and I was debased, and I was all used up. By then, Charlie was sober probably, I don't know, maybe 9 months. I went home to my mother that day, and she said, let me call Charlie. As I called the doctor and found out that I was going to have a baby, I didn't have a job, I didn't have a place to live, I didn't have anything but a real bad problem with alcohol and alcohol's cousins. By then, alcohol's cousins had entered into it, and me and alcohol and alcohol's cousins were having family reunions about every day. So I got over there with my mom, and she called Charlie, and Charlie showed up, and he reached his hand out to me, and he said, Sissy, please. He said, please let me help you. I let him help me with what I needed for that day. And I was off and running over and over and over again. That baby boy was born in January of 1984, and my family rallied around me, and by then, my youngest brother is sober. I mean, they're all falling down like dominoes, man. Not me. I don't need you. I'm really glad you got it, though, because you needed it. I went back to live at my mother's, and shortly after that, I think my best friend moved in. My mother and my best friend and I, we were like three honky-tonk angels. We were running around all over every little joint in Louisville, and then they started going to Al-Anon. And man, I was like, I was angry. So they were going to Al-Anon. They were telling all my secrets. And I had some secrets. And I thought it was all about me. You know, it was just me. It wasn't anybody else in the world but me. And I was trying to take care of that little baby boy. And I was drunk all the time. They were having to step up and do the things that I really wanted to do as a mother. But I would take a drink. And then when I take that drink, I can't predict to you how long I'm going to drink, who I'm going to drink it with, what we're going to do once we drink it. So I thank God that my family was there to fill the gaps for Adam during those years. As I said, got into a lot of alcohol's relationships with alcohol's cousins, and I was a, you know, Darren talked about it last night, and I was one that had seizures, you know, and I can remember coming out of a seizure on the dining room floor, and my mother and my little brother over me with tears rolling down their face, begging me to go get help. But what I needed that day more than help was I needed another one. And I left them standing on the porch, pleading with me. You know, for all the emotional appeal, self seldom suffices. I had a lot of frothy emotional appeal in my life. I had a lot of people that loved me, a lot of people that cared about me. The frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. And I ended up sometime the next year on August the 1st of 1985. And I was going into my last drunk. Now, isn't it interesting? We don't know it's our last drunk. Because if I'd known it was my last drunk, it wouldn't have been at the Tim Tam. That was the Tim Tam before it was remodeled. That was a stinky little beer joint over on Clark's Lane in Germantown, Kevin's back room. And I ended up over there that evening, and as the beer joint closed, we stayed after. They locked the door, and we continued to drink. And I had a baby at home that was a year old. And my mother and my best friend were stepping up and doing all the things that I should have been doing as a mother. Somehow I made it out of there, and I got home, and I went home and passed out for a few hours. And as the sun began to just come up, maybe 6 o'clock in the morning, started to get light. The sun was seeping through the blinds in that bedroom that I shared with my little baby boy. I was on one side of the room in a twin bed, and he was on the other side of the room in a baby bed. And I was 30 years old, and I was a mess. I was unemployed, and I didn't know how to take care of myself, much less a baby. I came to that morning, and the first miracle of that day happened for me. I came to it out of that alcoholic stupor, and I recognized myself in just a split second as an alcoholic. And that was the opening for everything else to happen for me to be here. And the second miracle of that day quickly followed, and I reached out to a God that I didn't even think would want anything to do with me, because I was a bad girl. That's what I thought. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you said, "Colleen, sicker you are, the more he loves you." It's like, man, I'm glad to hear that. I am so glad to hear that, because I didn't think that I was good enough to go to God. I had felt an emptiness all my life. I had felt a void all my life. I used to sit up in my mother's attic, you know, smoking pot and doing other things and reading Hugh Prather, trying to find the solution, you know. And that morning, I reached out. I took a chance on God. I took a risk on God, because I knew that if I got up out of that bed and I walked out of that bedroom that morning and did one more anything, that I was going to die. I was in bad shape. I had all the bedevilments on page 52. I was suffering. I was prone to misery. I had them all. They were all there. I laid around that day, and as it got toward the evening, my mother and my best friend said they were going to their Al-Anon meeting, and I got up and I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the third miracle of the day happened for me, as me and my mother and my best friend climbed the steps of the Token 3 Club on Dutchman's Lane together. Together. Arm in arm. We got sober. Barbie has a different sobriety date. She stayed for a while and came back. But I stayed sober, because I knew that night, as I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous at that Saturday night meeting, Rolf, I knew that I was in my seat. I knew that I had paid so many prices to be there. I got a home group. I got a sponsor. And I got a big bad boyfriend. Now, I don't know who your all's boyfriend or girlfriend was in AA. Mine was the president. I'll tell you a little story about that. He told me I was a cross-addicted alcoholic. So I started introducing myself as a cross-addicted alcoholic. I got asked to speak at a meeting over at the old mall group one night. I was about 9 months sober. And I showed up and I introduced myself as a cross-addicted alcoholic. There was three old-timers on the back row back there. They're all gone on to the big meeting of Sky, so I'll tell you who they are. Bob Pack, Steve Dugan, and Ray Halsey.
Ray Halsey.
Jesus. And they all stood up and they banged their metal chairs together. And they walked out of the meeting. I was devastated. I mean, I kind of fancied myself as the princess of AA. And they left. And after that meeting, I stopped by the Token Club on my way home. And they said, come here, girl. They were back at the round table, taking everybody's inventory. And they said, come here, girl. And I went back there and I sat down. And they said, look. We don't care what else you are. We know you're a drunk. Do you know you're a drunk? I said, yeah. He said, that's all you have to be. We don't care. We don't care what else you are. After I thought about it, it sort of felt like a promotion. I never had to introduce myself as a cross-addicted alcoholic again. And I began to embrace the singleness of purpose and understand the importance of the singleness of purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've always had a home group. I've had so many wonderful experiences happen to me. I've had some self-will decisions that came back and bit me in the butt. I married a guy that I should never have married. And he only relapsed for one day. It's just one day. And I ended up marrying him, and we set out on a journey that was about 3 years long and 3 years too long, and it was very painful, and my family had to watch me really go through a lot, and but during those years, I clung to my son, and Adam was a really good little basketball player. I'll tell you a story about him. He was 12 years old, and he was asked to be on this prestigious AAU traveling team, and so I'm trying to give him all these finite, you know, ideas like, oh, I don't know, you might not get to play, and it's probably political, and you know, all these things, and Adam's like, Mom, I just want to be there. He'd been going to that ALA team meeting on Thursday nights in Bardstown, and he's like, I just want to be there. And so we suited up and showed up, and back then they played Lexington Catholic. Patino's son was coaching. And my son didn't get to start. And he's sitting on the bench, and I'm like, my son's the best player on the team. I don't know why. I don't know why they're not putting him in the game. I'm 11 years sober in the bleachers, and I'm like, that coach doesn't know what he's doing. He does not know what he's doing. He needs to put Adam in that game. We got about 2 minutes left on the clock, and we're down by 8 points, and the kid that started in front of Adam fouled out. Because God always has a plan, doesn't he? That kid fouled out, thank God. And Adam got up off of the bench and he went into the game, and man, he started making those beautiful threes that he had learned to shoot right up here at UK basketball camp. And we get down, we're like, I don't know, 18 seconds on the clock or something. We're still down by 2 points. So he drives in for a layup. He's a little point guard. Drives in for a layup. He misses the layup, but he gets fouled. We're down by 2 points, and he goes to the free throw line. And actually, we're down by 1 point. I'm sorry. Goes to the free throw line, and he makes both the free throws. And they carry him off the floor. Now, 5 or 10 minutes before that, I'm up in the bleachers, and I'm saying, they need to put Adam in that game. That coach doesn't know what he's doing. You see, I never know what God's plan is going to be. But I think I know what God's plan is going to be. Well, Adam was the hero of that game that day. And I say that every time because I want to remember how God makes me right-sized in the moment. Because I think I know more than I do. I think I know more than I do. And I'm driven by 100 forms of fear and self-delusion and all those things. And I can make myself believe anything if I need to bad enough. You know, the 12 and 12 talks about rationalization is our ancient enemy. Rationalization. And you know, he was the hero of the game that day, and they carried him off the floor, and I was present in my sobriety station in those bleachers. 11 years sober, with tears rolling down my cheeks, grateful that that coach had finally seen the light. Yeah. Fast forward a couple of years, and it's a regular weekday, and I knock on the door of my mom, and mom's home, and she brings me in, and I'm 10 years sober, and so she's 10 years sober. Now, my mother and I had a very combative relationship. You know, I wasn't the princess that she wanted, and we fought a lot. It was a real tug of war between us in our home. She pulled me into her living room that day, and it was that time of year after Thanksgiving and before Christmas, and she said, "Come here, I want to show you something." And she pulled me into the living room, and she had this big life-size doll sitting on the sofa. And I said, "Oh, Mom, you got that doll for Catherine, who was my two-year-old niece." And my mom walked around that sofa table, and she picked that doll up, and she brought it over to me. She said, "No, I got that doll for my little girl." And she wrapped that doll's arms around me. And in a perfect moment of God's grace, every single time that I relied to her, every single time she ever put a missing persons report out on me, every single time that I ever stole from her, diminished in God's perfect moment of grace. Perfect moment of grace. Now, walking into her place that morning, knocking on that door, I had no idea what I was about to walk into. So when you're present in your sobriety station, you never know what miracle is going to come to you today. You never know. I was 11 years sober, and when I was 5 years sober, I had started working on some very difficult amends that I had postponed for a long time, and I decided to sit down and write my first husband, who, love of my life, write him a letter. To try and make the amends. And I wrote him a letter, and I told him that I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that in order for me to stay sober, that I had to go back and clean up all of the hurt and the harm that I had caused, and that he was at the top of my list. So I'd like to meet with you in the presence of your wife. Now, that's not what I wanted to say. I wanted to say, "Michael, how about me and you, you know, taking a roll?" But I followed some directions that day, and I mailed that letter, and I was 5 years sober, and I never heard back from Michael. He didn't respond. But I had done enough work, and just taking that simple action had brought me some relief. So I fast forward 6 years to now I'm 11 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I get a phone call, and my mother's telling me that Michael's father had died and that her and my brothers were going to the funeral home, and because they had all remained good friends. And he often comes to hear us sing with his wife. And our parents had known each other all their lives. And there was something in me that I knew that that's not what I was supposed to do that morning. And I told her, "I'm not going to do that. I'm not sure what I'm going to do yet. And I didn't go with them to the funeral home visitation. And the next morning, I drove into Louisville from Bardstown, and very early in the morning, I arrived at the funeral home, and they weren't open yet. But I knew that the people that worked there were there because there were keys hanging in the door. And I knocked on the door, and one of the guys that worked there came out, and he let me in. And he let me go back to make my visitation and my amends at the casket to Michael's father, Paul. And for some reason, I don't know why, I hung around. I got up off the kneeler. I began to just kind of look at the flowers and hang around in that room that morning. And when I got ready to leave, boom, right there. There he was, the love of my life, whose heart I had broken over and over again. And God had placed him right in front of me. His wife wasn't with him. He comes from a huge Catholic family. Not one person was with him. And Michael and I stood alone together in that hallway at Bossy Funeral Home on that morning. And I took the ninth step. And we laughed and we cried and we told stories on each other. And here's the big thing. We left in peace. And every time that he didn't know where I was, and every time that I lied to him, and every time that I did everything against him in our marriage, diminished in that perfect moment of grace. There is a line in the ninth step in the 12 and 12. It talks about a careful sense of timing. And I knew in that moment that at 5 years I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready to take that amends. But at 11 years sober, I was. It was one of the greatest gifts of my sobriety. I've had so many blessings. You know, on November the 15th of 1982, they didn't know where I was when my daddy was taking his last breaths. But if you fast forward to February the 28th of 2003, when my mama was taking her last breaths, me and all three of my sober brothers and other members of Alcoholics Anonymous and family members were at her bedside in that hospital that morning. And everybody that knows us knows how much we all love to sing. And my sister-in-law, Ann, said to us that day, "Why don't you all sing to your mom?" And so we gathered around and formed a circle, and we sang to her that day all the favorite songs of her life that she taught us growing up. "You're nobody till somebody loves you." As you see, I realized that I was 40 years old before I let my mama love me. And it all came in a moment that God gave us with that big doll. That it wasn't that she didn't love me. It wasn't that I couldn't be what she wanted me to be. It wasn't any of that. It was that I suffered from a spiritual malady that I was unable to experience love. I went back and graduated from college. I was a single mother. I was driving back and forth to Frankfurt every day for work. And I was going to Spalding University on the weekends to get my college degree. And I remember the night that I walked across the stage and received that college degree. And I looked out and all I could see was my family there. All my brothers, my mother, my sisters-in-law, my nieces and nephews, my son. And I remember later that evening my mother saying this to me. She said, Colleen, you've become the woman that I always wanted you to be. But what stood in the way of me and becoming the person that God made me to be was a bottle of booze. A bottle of booze. I look out today and I have so many friends. My friend Robin. I love him. So many friends here that I've known forever, that have watched me get sober, helped me get sober, that I walk through sobriety with on a daily basis, that I have the gift of sponsoring people who have made an impact on my life, people who have showed me how to save my life, people who are far better members of Alcoholics Anonymous than I am. But I go back and I remember the guys and the gals that were sober here. The Jacks, the Dougs, the Bernies, the Ronnies. All those guys. The Carters. He used to say, the third step is irrevocable. Oh my God. I'm scared. I'd be in that little newcomers group every week, and they'd say, does anybody have any questions? Yes, I do. Yeah. Well, now, how am I going to know when it's God's will? Go, don't worry about that. If you thought of it, it ain't God's will. And then Charlie would come home and he'd put all those one-liners on me that Tinkin was giving him, like, well, no, you know when you know you don't know. God, what does that mean? You know, I want to complicate it. Thank God for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God for the life that you have given not only me, but my whole family. To be able to, I was just with my little brother a few weeks ago at his home group. Patrick celebrated 40 years. He got sober. He was 20 years old. Yeah. What a gift. Yeah. When I came to that morning, it was Patrick's eyes that I saw. Because, quite honestly, Charlie tried to 12-stomp me into Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God. God moved Charlie and Ann to Lexington so that there was a seat for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I couldn't be more grateful. There's some, you know, this is a family disease, and there's something very special about being able to recover with your family. And I go, you know, I have a son who is suffering tremendously with his alcoholism. He's suffering tremendously. But I know this. I know that when he comes through that door, that you'll be there. Thank you. God bless all of you. I hope we always stay here. Thanks.